You know, you could be a very smart person in physics and not necessarily with people. And because you're really knowledgeable about one area doesn't mean you're knowledgeable of every area.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see some of the struggles of someone that is brilliant and yet trying to develop an ethic for that.
This podcast is brought to you by Blackbee Ministries International. To find out more, visit blackbee.org.
Well, welcome to the Richard Blackaby Leadership Podcast. My name is Sam Camp, and I'm your host, and I'm joined by Dr. Richard Blackaby today.
As always, a pleasure to be with you, Sam.
So good to see you again, Richard, and we've got a great show on the docket today.
Yeah.
We're going to dive into some great history, a book that we actually have both read, and so I've occasionally we'll do a biography in your honor, and but before we get to that, I want to mention the upcoming coaching workshop that we have.
Yeah.
We do these twice a year in the Atlanta area. And the next one is coming up April 29th to May 1st. It's in person. It's hands-on. You're going to be practicing coaching, learning what coaching is, how to ask better questions to move people onto God's agenda. It's going to be at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church. They're a little north of Atlanta. Richard, what is there anything that you want to share about that before we move on?
No, just that hopefully you're not intimidated by that. People, some really amazing people coming in from all over the country for about 2.5 days or so of just intensive training and practice. And it's just always really amazing what God does. You come there being trained so you can help others, but typically you end up being helped a lot while you're there in
yeah.
the workshop. And so always really very rich time, and so really strongly encourage you, if you can make the time to come to North Atlanta, I think it'll definitely be worth your while.
Yeah, and we'll leave links to that in the show notes, blackabycoaching.org, to find out more. So Richard, we are looking at a biography of a very fascinating individual.
Yeah, I thought today, we haven't looked at a biography for a little while, and so I thought it might be good just to look at one today. And I want to look at the biography on J. Robert Oppenheimer, the mm-hmm. Father of the atomic bomb. And it's looking at the particular biography that I read is by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin. And it was their biography upon which the Academy Award-winning movie was made, and
yeah.
which I guess won Best Picture, along with a bunch of other Academy Awards recently.
It raked in some awards, directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, one of
Hollywood's great
yeah,
directors.
You and Daniel love Nolan. I haven't seen the movie, but I tend to just go straight to the biography to get
yeah.
to the real in-depth stuff. So,
which is when I heard the movie was coming out last year or so, that's when I said, oh, I should, you know, I had access to the audiobook version, and so, yeah, I kind of binged through that last year.
Yeah, and so I thought it'd be interesting. I just finished it recently, and so just a lot of fresh kind of thoughts on him. If you don't know anything about Oppenheimer, his parents actually were German immigrants, came from Germany, spoke German, but when they moved to New York City, they really wanted to quickly adapt to being American, so they raised up Robert and his brother Frank to be Americans, to speak English. They were also Jewish, and I think both of those factors played into Oppenheimer in some way. You know, Oppenheimer is without a question, he's a brilliant person with a brilliant mind. He's going to learn a number of languages. He's going to understand very complex problems in physics. He's going to figure out how to make an atomic bomb. And so there's no question he's got huge brain power. And, you know, it's often interesting to me, you know, people have different IQs. They have different forms of intelligence. But some people, clearly, even as children, are quite gifted. They learn things very rapidly. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who's smart ends up being successful.
Yeah.
There's a lot of dips and turns and twists along the way in life where some brilliant people just end up having pretty frustrating lives. And then there's some that they, along the way, they find a pathway that where they can use their intelligence for good or for evil, but they find a way to tap into that and make something of it. And so Oppenheimer certainly is someone like that. As a child, they said he, number one, he was brilliant. Early on, I guess, he developed a liking for just collecting rocks and studying them and categorizing them. And he actually sent a couple of letters into the New York City Gemnologist Society. Apparently, whoever he was writing to was quite impressed with his experience and his insight. And so they actually invited him to provide a lecture to their society. And that caused Oppenheimer to be a little bit panicky because he was only 12 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And he kind of said, Dad, you got to tell him I'm only 12. But brilliant in terms of just knowing things like that. But at the same time, he also was socially awkward. His biographers say that he didn't really have very many close friends growing up. And even later, when he was in university, he just had an awkward side to him where he might just speak up a lot. He's the sort of typical brainiac kind of student that would challenge professors who were lecturing to him. And yeah. A lot of his professors would end up winning Nobel Prizes. He went to, of course, went to Harvard. He went to Cambridge. Went to Göttingen, and so he went to very good schools with brilliant professors, and yet still he would challenge them, and he would see inconsistencies, and his brain just worked so quickly that he was very quickly racing ahead and thinking through things. And so the kind of person that could either be very irritating. In fact, I think at one point the fellow students made a petition to the professor to plead with the professor to make Oppenheimer not talk so much in class. They wanted to hear the professor, not yeah. him. So, but nonetheless, and also he had some just real angst that he seems to have gone through early on in his life. In fact, at one point when he was at Cambridge, he got so stressed out that he actually left allegedly, a poisoned apple on the teacher's desk, the professor's desk. I guess to perhaps poison his professor, which I'm not sure really what drove him to that. But he had just some real emotional struggles and issues early on in his university days that eventually he found a breakthrough. And the biographers sort of address that, but they don't necessarily... I don't know, adequately explain, I guess because they can't get inside his head to know, but
yeah.
I think partly being Jewish, he faced some anti-Semitism and teasing and so on at times from kids. But he also went to a school that was an expensive private school, and the school had some very strong personalities as teachers, and they really impressed upon their students the need to make a difference in their society, to make society better. And that would resonate quite strongly with Oppenheimer. And so later, as a young adult, an emerging professor, he would invest himself in trying to help the down and out, or people that were not receiving justice. And so even things like helping teachers unions or longshoremen unions, that working people that maybe were being not paid well or treated right. And at that time in the 1930s, certainly Franklin Roosevelt was pushing the New Deal and government programs to help people. But probably foremost at that time was relatively small but active Communist Party in the United States. And Oppenheimer never really necessarily was attracted to all the political side of communism, but he did like the fact that they were pretty vocal about helping the working class and the exploited, and that resonated with him. And of course, people had not yet seen the horrors of Stalin and so on, and this, what would become the Soviet Union. And so, and so it just seemed like, yeah, these guys really are working to help the poor and the working class. And so he would donate money, he'd attend meetings, he would be active in helping teachers' unions, making sure teachers got fair pay and so on. And that would all come back to haunt him later, because he was involved with some actual communists, and he donated to some communist causes later when the U.S. became quite paranoid about the Soviets and that arms race and so on. That would come back to bite him. But at the time, he was just trying to find his own way. How can I make society better? By volunteering, by lecturing, or by giving money.
Yeah.
And so he gets a job. I think while he works on his master's degree and as he's kind of doing his advanced studies in Europe, he begins publishing papers, and he begins to find his own way. He discovers physics is a field in which he can really harness his brain power, and he starts to make a name for himself, and he starts to make some contacts that will be allies and colleagues of his for years to come. And you know, it's always fascinating when you see someone that is fortunate enough to link their career with their passions. With what you know, their people's brains work in different ways, and some people never really find a job that uses their brain the way their brain is works best. And so they kind of hate their jobs. But Oppenheimer found a field that that he could excel in. And the commentator or the biographers say that he was never that good at details. He was the side of physics that involved mathematics, which took a lot of time to work out mathematical formulas and so on. And Oppenheimer understood the process, but his biographers say that he was his mind was racing, and he was always going from this to that, and so he could very quickly figure out issues and so on. But he didn't always have the patience to stick with something long enough to see it through right to the conclusion or the breakthrough. And so the biographers say that he actually was a great catalyst. He would recognize an issue. He would mobilize people to address it. He'd inspire them. He'd give them great help and feedback and ideas. But then there'd always be some others kind of following along behind him that would stick with it and ultimately get a Nobel Prize in physics because they solved problems that Oppenheimer maybe had kind of set them onto in the first place.
Yeah.
And that, of course, that would really help him later when he was tasked to lead the whole effort to build the atomic bomb. And just a couple of things about this book, I think, that they addressed that I found particularly interesting. One is just the whole focus on making the bomb in the first place. What I guess I knew vaguely about, but not in great detail, was that that the Germans were trying to make the atomic bomb too. And when Oppenheimer studied in Europe, he actually got to know a lot of the people that were now working in Germany. He knew the head of the whole atomic bomb program in Germany was someone that he had gotten to know over time. And there was a kind of a common fear that the Germans might be 2 years ahead of the Americans in making the bomb. And so I think a lot of the, when a lot of the scientists, I think one of the things that is kind of new is that before this time, a respectable scientist, certainly a physicist, did not invest his life, his studies in making weapons. They studied the universe, they studied planets or gravity or various things, but they didn't study just how to make a better bomb. And so this is new for them. But what motivated a lot of them to do that was the fear of stopping Hitler. And if Hitler, who was occupying all of Europe, suddenly had an atomic bomb, then how would you ever get him out of Europe? And so it was, they were definitely doing it in a race to beat Hitler. But then, of course, Hitler ends up committing suicide and being defeated before they can, either side can make an atomic bomb. And so, and the Americans know that the Japanese aren't working on an atomic bomb. And so the race is kind of over. And so one of the things I found interesting was they'd never really made the atomic bomb to use on Japan. They were using it in a race against Germany. But now all of a sudden you've got this moral dilemma. Do you use a weapon of this magnitude on the Japanese? And by July of 1945, they're ready to test the bomb. And Oppenheimer said, well, we definitely have to at least have one test detonation. And it took a lot of uranium, a lot of work to make one bomb. The bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima apparently weighed over 9,000 pounds. It was called Little Boy. It was a nickname, which is kind of a misnomer.
Yeah.
And so Oppenheimer is beginning to think through a little bit ethically to say, what do we do with this bomb? And one thing the way I've always heard it described to me, and I've read quite a bit of 20th century history, is that the Americans felt like, you know, they had tried to take Okinawa and Iwo Jima and some of these islands, and the Japanese soldiers had fought to the death on them, and there had been heavy casualties because they were entrenched on these islands, and they made the Americans pay dearly for every foot that they gained on the island. And so the theory was, well, just imagine how much they'll fight when we land on Japan itself. We'll have to fight street by street and mile by mile, and the estimates were as high as 1 million casualties it would take to capture all of Japan. So the argument has always been, well, so America dropped an atomic bomb just to save all those American lives that would have been lost invading in a traditional way. But in the book, they point out a couple of things. One is that by that time, by July of 1945, they had defeated basically the Japanese Navy and Air Force, and American planes, bombers, were going over by just in swarms over Japan.
Well, they had just firebombed all of Tokyo by that point.
Yeah, and so and they might have as many as 100,000 casualties just from normal bombing and firebombing. So, you know, that Japan could not sustain a whole lot of that and carry on as it was. And so apparently there was much evidence that the Japanese government was they knew that they had lost. They knew they could not win the war.
Yeah.
And so their biggest concern was they were willing to surrender, but they only on the condition that they could keep their emperor, that their constitution wouldn't be changed so that they couldn't have an emperor anymore. And so if the U.S. had just seriously taken that on, they would never have had to drop a bomb. And I think for the scientists, their problem was you drop an atomic bomb on a city, you're not killing a bunch of soldiers who are fighting against you. You're killing a bunch of citizens, a bunch of women and children and innocent civilians. And do you need to kill 100,000 of them just to make a point? And so Oppenheimer had even suggested to the U.S. government, why don't you just bring a Japanese ambassador to Los Alamos and let him watch us blow up our first atomic bomb? If a government trusted agent from Japan comes over and sees the magnitude of this bomb we've invented, he'll scurry back to Japan and tell them, quick, let's surrender before they drop that on one of our cities.
Yeah.
And that seemed to make sense. It seemed to make sense. You could make your point without killing 100,000 citizens, civilians, but and so Oppenheimer is trying to make that case, and And he, in a sense, trusted probably naively the government, the U.S. government. One of the challenges was that that they knew that Stalin was planning to get to declare war on Japan by August 15th. And so the U.S. knew that once he declared, they didn't really need him to declare war at that point. Japan was about to surrender. But the problem is that that once Stalin declared war, even if he didn't fight any Japanese, he still would want something for his efforts. He'd want to claim territory from Japan. And so they just didn't want Stalin getting his foot in the door. And so they kind of wanted to keep him out. And so they thought, well, if we can drop an atomic bomb, we'll end the war quickly, and we'll also kind of show Stalin what we've got, and so he'll know not to mess with us. And so ultimately, they made the decision to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, and on August 6th, which is my wedding anniversary, so I always remember that. And it was devastating. And it shook Japan. And one of the book doesn't go into much detail about it, but the fact that 3 days later they dropped another bomb was definitely very hard on a lot of those scientists. They thought, if you did obliterate an entire city in Japan, that ought to be demonstration enough. But there had been some question. People were so blown away by the explosion, they just couldn't imagine that wasn't some kind of fluke, and so they decided to show them it wasn't a fluke, that they could do that to every city if they chose to. And so another city is destroyed, and at that point Japan surrenders very quickly, and the war is over. But then comes a huge debate about what do we do now? Like, we are the United States is the only country in the world that has a nuclear weapon, but the Soviets are going to want one too badly. And so there was a big debate among the scientists saying, what if we share a certain amount of knowledge? They kind of assumed that any self-respecting scientist could probably figure out a lot of the details just by measuring the atmosphere, seeing what was in the air afterward. Just the physics that was common knowledge among physicists around the world.
Yeah.
And so they kind of figured, the Soviets are going to figure this out at some point. Maybe better, instead of surrounding it with secrecy and control, and we're the only ones with this kind of weapon. They agonized over how can we make this somehow where maybe there's some kind of worldwide organization that controls all nuclear power and all nuclear weapons. And the scientists were racking their brains how to avoid just an arms race with the Soviet Union. Looking back, some of it seems kind of naive. Some of it might have been somewhat doable. Of course, knowing Stalin, there's no real sense that he would have ever given up any control of his country to be able to share in the knowledge of nuclear power. But it is an interesting discussion. And after that explosion and the war is over, Oppenheimer becomes one of the most famous people in the world. And he goes around speaking, and he's brought into all kinds of government committees, and he's brought to Washington, D.C. often. I think he likes that. He likes the influence. He likes being able to speak his mind. I think he also just realizes, though, that typically the government doesn't listen to him. There'll typically be people that find him very compelling, very insightful, but the powers that be have a hard time thinking that it's practical to share knowledge of nuclear power and to in any way work with the Russians. And so the very thing that he doesn't want to happen basically happens.
Yeah.
And there is an arms race. And he asked some significant questions. There was a group of scientists, there was one in particular that had worked with him on the atomic bomb, and he knows that they can make it a different way, basically develop a hydrogen bomb. They called it a super bomb. It would be even more powerful. And Oppenheimer just is appalled that, okay, here we go. It's already a nuclear bomb's,
not
atomic
enough.
Bomb's not enough. We need more. And he was kind of like, at that point, he said, it's not that the bomb is too big. He said, it's interesting. He said, the problem is all the targets are too small. He said, there's no target big enough that it requires a hydrogen bomb to take it out. He said, it's just basically a tool of genocide. It's just, if you want to obliterate an entire city, then you use that. But it's not a military weapon. He said, you don't use it for military purposes.
Because that was a lot of the, I think, discussion early on was using it like in Navy battles or something. If you could drop a nuclear, more of a tactical, I guess, what we would consider a tactical nuclear weapon on like warships that are approaching, you know, that would be sort of a great advantage. But it was never really, I don't think, conceived of that it would just be used to bomb a city.
Yeah, well,
at least, but not by the scientists anyway.
Yeah, the scientists, yeah. But very quickly, what happens is the Air Force sort of takes over the whole nuclear warfare approach. And what happens over time is that the U.S. starts to just cut back on all of its conventional weapons of tanks and artillery and boots on the ground, and just says, the Air Force basically says, we don't need to keep big armies in Europe. All we need is just some bombers that can drop atomic bombs. And so Oppenheimer just sees this as a problem because that's becoming the U.S.'s only defense. So if there is a war, and Oppenheimer had tried to get the U.S. to agree that it would never drop a bomb first, that of going forward, that if there was ever a war, they would never just opt for that. But the U.S. government would never agree to that, because they knew that if they didn't scare the Soviets and say, yeah, if you invade Europe, we won't promise you that we won't drop an atomic bomb in all your tanks. And so Oppenheimer tried to somehow get, and I don't think that he necessarily thought he even had all the answers, but he just felt like he didn't trust military people to know all the information, and the average citizen not to. He talked a lot about candor, and it ought to be a national debate. You shouldn't just leave it up to the generals or the Air Force to decide how many nuclear weapons is enough. And
right.
At one point he said he was pretty certain that their 20,000 nuclear bombs would not in any significant way hinder the Soviets with their 2,000 nuclear bombs. He just said at some point, I mean, how many nuclear bombs do you have to stockpile before it becomes redundant?
Right.
And he just saw some real paranoia and some madness, and thought there's got to be some other way to negotiate arms controls and limits to how many you have in your stockpile and so on. But along the way, maybe just the last part for him is just that he makes some powerful enemies, because there are people, and of course is the rising paranoia of the Soviet Union. If you even question what your government is doing, if you even suggest maybe there's another approach, it looks like disloyalty. It looks like treason.
Yeah.
And so he's in a very prominent place, and he's just asking people to think. And he refused to help build the hydrogen bomb. And he raised big questions about just how big of a bomb do you need? If you can blow up an entire city, isn't that bomb probably enough? But that later is seen as treason, as sabotage. People say, well, we would have come up with the hydrogen bomb sooner if Oppenheimer hadn't been opposed to it and holding us back. And so eventually, it's a very interesting case. It take too long to describe it all here, but in the book it just basically outlines a witch trial where he gets accused of a number of things, which mostly are things that have been in his file for years, that people have known that he gave money to communist causes and so on, and basically everything that they try him on, he was checked out on years and years before.
Yeah.
But there's a new person that hates Oppenheimer and is determined to destroy him. And it's really appalling when you read just how many different ways they abuse the legal system.
Yeah.
just
circumvent the legal system.
Yeah, and I mean, like one of the main things was that you had to have a security clearance to be able to see Oppenheimer's file, which had all the incriminating information and innuendo, and like the FBI, if they just even wondered something, if they speculated without evidence about Oppenheimer, they would put a memo in his file. There's no evidence for it, no proof for it, but there's a memo now that you can read if you read his file that some FBI agent wonders about this.
And so many just unlawful wiretaps surveillance of
American
citizens.
Yeah, much of that was completely illegal and unnecessary. But so when he has this hearing, they take away Oppenheimer's security clearance and then they don't give it to his attorneys. So his defense team isn't allowed basically to see the evidence. They can't see the file. Whereas the prosecuting team has all read the evidence, and there's a panel of three kind of judges, and they're all allowed to see the evidence. So the only people who don't know the evidence is the defendant and his team. And so so the prosecutor would be quoting from documents that the defense had never even seen. And people feel that the biographers say that he got an attorney to defend him who was not a trial lawyer, was not used to the give and take of all the trial dynamics. And a seasoned lawyer would have probably just put a stop to it and just refused to let his client even go further until he could at least see the evidence that his client was being charged with. But he went on with it, and it was even then it was a 2-1 vote on the panel. But just over and over again, there were just incredible abuses of the system. But it was just felt like, well, even if I don't have evidence, I just feel like he's guilty. Or in fact, once the panel of three came to its recommendation, then a panel of five actually had to decide what to do with him. And interestingly, the panel voted 4-1 that Oppenheimer was not disloyal. So they couldn't, there's no evidence that he was disloyal. There's no evidence he'd ever shared any information with anybody that he shouldn't. But then they also voted 4-1 to take away his security clearance. And so it's like, well, you voted 4-1 that he is honest and trustworthy, but then you've also voted to take away his security clearance anyway.
Yeah.
And it was just riddled with, just
political. There's so much,
But they wanted to destroy, they knew that they couldn't really convict him on disloyalty or espionage, but what they wanted to do was just cast enough shadows of doubt on his character that he couldn't keep making speeches and sway public opinion. They wanted to discredit him so he didn't have any influence anymore. And that ultimately fails. And interestingly, sadly, Eisenhower and Truman, those presidents, were so intimidated by the anti-communist, McCarthyist rabble that they both knew that Oppenheimer was not guilty, but they didn't want to wade in and rescue him because it might look like they were soft on communism or something. And so a lot of people just kind of remained quiet. But a lot of the scientists, though, rallied to his support, were very upset. And they just felt like, are we just like the Soviet Union, where if you can't oppose government opinion or else you're going to, they'll trump up charges against you and destroy your career? And there were a lot of those where scientists that perhaps had supported a left-wing organization back in their youth, and all of a sudden the FBI would come and tell the university that had hired them about that, and the next thing you'd know, that professor would be fired, even though he wasn't active, hadn't been involved in years with that. But you just dreaded that people might find some indiscretion of your youth where you had supported the wrong side in some way, and you could lose your career over that. And so that Strauss, that was the ringleader against Oppenheimer, ultimately, interestingly enough, Eisenhower later wants to make him his commerce secretary, which would have been the highest government job that he would get. Would be the apex of his career. But there were enough scientists that came to friends that they had in government. And one of those friends was a very close friend of JFK, who was a senator at the time. And the Senate had to affirm those cabinet positions. And JFK actually votes against it and causes him to not be appointed. And so, in a sense, Oppenheimer gets some revenge on it. It's not that Oppenheimer was doing it, but his friends were.
Yeah.
And when JFK becomes the president, he actually invites Oppenheimer to a gathering of 49 Nobel laureates. And at that meeting, JFK makes a famous quote. He looks at 49 different people who've won a Nobel Prize, and he says, "Probably never in the history of the White House has there ever been a gathering of such brain power, except," he said, "perhaps when Thomas Jefferson dined alone," he said. And so then JFK decides to give him a very prestigious award. It'd be a $50,000 cash prize, and basically to repatriate him and to acknowledge that he's actually a great hero of America, not a traitor. JFK will die, will be assassinated before that event, but Lyndon Johnson will give it to him. And so although they never give him back his security clearance, I think at that point he wasn't willing to go through another hearing. He said, "That's fine. I don't need it anymore." And he becomes just something of a lecturer, an intellectual, someone that can comment on the person who basically invented the atomic bomb now is being something of a world conscience and speaking out to help people think. And Oppenheimer was a very nervous person in some ways, had some nervous habits. And one of those was he was a chain smoker, smoked 4 to 5 packs of cigarettes a day, and ultimately comes down with lung cancer or throat cancer, but a cancer that came from his smoking. And he'll die at the age of 62, feeling deeply betrayed by the very country that he worked so hard to save and to help, but also wanting right to the very end to prove that he was a loyal American. Never really complained about how he was treated, at least publicly. Never really tried to question the process. Just spent the rest of his life trying to prove that what that panel had said about his loyalty wasn't true, that he was reliable. And so it's just it's a fascinating, he's probably the highest profile victim of the McCarthy kind of communist witch hunts of the 50s, but it's also interesting just to see, you know, you could be a very smart person in physics and not necessarily with people, and because you're really knowledgeable about one area doesn't mean you're knowledgeable of every area.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see some of the struggles of someone that is brilliant and yet trying to develop an ethic for that. And he was never a Christian. He actually really liked the Bhagavad Gita from Hinduism, was kind of his text that he was impressed with. And maybe just one last sort of irony, his integrity is going to be challenged. Can he be trustworthy? Is he trustworthy with national secrets and so on? And he feels very hurt that his integrity would be questioned. He does have, at least the authors point out, at least two adulterous affairs he has or relationships while he's married. And so it is a bit ironic that a guy that is protesting his integrity for national secrets, though for his own personal reasons, feels it's all right to have relationships with people other than his wife. He's yeah. always stays married to his wife, just one of these people so brilliant in certain ways and yet lots of struggles in others. He had two children. His son, I think, just always was kind of lost in the shadows of his brilliant parents. His daughter will ultimately commit suicide after Oppenheimer and his wife have died. And so it's kind of a tragic ending. Here's a brilliant yeah. person that is very good at certain things and yet in other ways, people would say he failed as a father, maybe perhaps a husband, and in some other ways, and just really seeing people for their motives and what they were like and how to respond to them. And so maybe cursed in part just being so heady and smart in certain things that he didn't take other things seriously enough. And so like so many characters in history, they make huge contributions, and yet at the same time, they've got their obvious shortcomings as well, just like we all do.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating read, and I highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. It's called American Prometheus, is a biography, and we'll leave links to that in the show notes. And I always like these history biography ones, Richard, so I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If this is something you enjoyed, it really makes a difference if you leave a review and a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Don't forget to subscribe and share with your friends. We always love hearing from our listeners, so email us at podcasts@blackbee.org